Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by contributors from community radio stations across Canada. This episode of Groundwire was produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gaking, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiwak and the Nakota. I'm your host, Michael Welch. On today's show...
They're not equipped to resolve, you know, the problems of homelessness or addiction.
We're focused on working conditions, wages, and benefits.
In autism, people who don't have services in time, they can have more behavioral problems.
But first, here are the headlines. Our first headline comes from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gaking, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiwak and the Nakota. From November 24th through 27th, the National Farmers Union held its annual convention in the city of Winnipeg. The theme this year was Farmers on the Front Line, celebrating 50 years of the farm movement. A strong focus of the four-day event was climate change, with presentations on farmers at the front line of the climate emergency, and a keynote address by Avi Lewis on a Green New Deal to address inequality, racism, and the climate crisis. Stuart Oak is a vegetable farmer from Quebec and NFU youth president. In a conversation with CKUW's Emily Leadham, Oak explained the NFU's particular interest in the climate theme.
The report that the NFU just released really draws a connection between agricultural inputs, which are sold overwhelmingly by agribusiness to farmers. And when we take a look at some of the agricultural emissions that are most significant from the agricultural sector, a lot of those emissions are caused by those same inputs. If we can adopt practices and promote practices which seek to reduce the amount of inputs that are used on farm, it can serve to reduce expenses for farmers, and it can also serve to reduce emissions for climate change. And so that way we can use both of them to the same effect.
For more information on the National Farmers Union, please visit the site nfu.ca. Files for this headline came from Emily Leadham and the program Rank and File Radio, Prairie Edition, which can be found on the program's SoundCloud page. Stéphane Christophe reports from Montreal, known as Chochake in the language of the Ganegahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, on the rights of warehouse workers in a recent report.
In Côte de Neige, the Immigrant Workers Center released a report on work conditions within Montreal's warehouse sector, which particularly hires new immigrants and low-income people. Joey Kulugai of the Immigrant Workers Center.
One of the major things that workers were pointing out was dangerous work conditions, the situations where they can get injured. Given that situation, also the lack of responsibility of the companies to equip them with proper health and safety equipment. Companies who hire through temp agencies, like for instance the Dollarama warehouse, who hires almost 95% of their workforce inside the warehouse through agencies, they wash their hands from that type of responsibility.
This is Stéphane Christophe reporting for Groundwire.
Our next headline comes from Catherine Fisher of CJLY-FM on Sinaixt, traditional territory.
In November 2019, the government of BC passed legislation to implement the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. BC's Declaration on the Right of Indigenous Peoples Act sets out a process to align BC's laws with the UN Declaration. The Act will mandate government to bring provincial laws into harmony with the UN Declaration, require development of an action plan to achieve this alignment, require regular reporting to the legislature to monitor progress, allow the province to enter into agreements with a broader range of Indigenous governments, and provide a framework for decision-making between Indigenous governments in the province. BC is the first province to put the UN Declaration into action and recognize Indigenous peoples' human rights in provincial law. Other provinces have tabled similar legislation, but these have not yet been passed.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back.
Bells will be ringing. It's sad, sad news. Oh, what a Christmas to have the blues. My baby's gone. I have no friends me greetings once again. Choirs will be singing. Christmas carols by candlelight. Please come home for Christmas. Please come home for Christmas. And if not Christmas, by New Year's.
You're listening to Groundwire Community Radio News, available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. You just heard Don Amaro with the song Please Come Home from his recent album, Amaro Little Christmas. Now it's time for our feature stories. Winnipeg has seen a spike in violent crimes in recent weeks. As of the end of October, there were 40 homicides in the Prairie City for the 2019 calendar year. Incidents have included the fatal stabbing of a 3-year-old boy and bold robberies from liquor stores, one of which left a clerk in the Tyndall Park neighborhood injured and sent to hospital. As the city is preparing its budget for the next 4 years, one of the most hotly debated items is whether or not to devote more spending to the service. Some community groups in the city, including the Indigenous-led Bear Clan Patrol, argued in delegation at a November 22nd Winnipeg Police Board meeting that increases were needed to sustain the effective partnership struck between their groups and the police, which were protecting communities. Members of a recently formed group believe that the Winnipeg police and their practices are actually contributing to the violence. Esther Wolf is a member of Winnipeg Police Cause Harm.
There have been attempts to collaborate with police by other organizations that are concerned for community safety and community protection, et cetera. And these measures and these initiatives haven't had the effect that they were intended to have, you know, by the people who made the decision, you know, to partner with police. Unfortunately, it hasn't resulted in less, you know, so-called crime, but it also hasn't resulted in less police violence against marginalized people. And it also hasn't been able to combat the austerity measures that are facing public services right now that are also impacting marginalized people.
A violent incident that has sparked debate within the city took place on the night before the police board meeting, when a youth emerged from a convenience store in the city's West End neighborhood. When the youth did not put down the machete he was holding above his head, when ordered to do so, an officer fired bullets at him 9 times.
They're not equipped to resolve, you know, the problems of homelessness or addiction or, unsupported mental health problems or intergenerational trauma. And in fact, they actually deepen these crises by, you know, criminalizing already very vulnerable populations, by displacing them through high rates of incarceration, and causing further trauma that can lead to further problems of addiction and things like that.
Dr. Kathleen Buttle is an associate professor of anthropology specializing in criminal anthropologies at the University of Manitoba.
The vast majority of deaths that occur in Winnipeg occur because people are suiciding. This number far outstrips the number of deaths by others. So to me, and a more important framing of this would be to talk about the epidemic of self-harm that is occurring on Winnipeg streets. Or we could talk about the rates of domestic violence, which also far outstrip the amount of so-called gang violence. What we should be focusing our moral energy on is decrying the lack of supports for youth who are in crisis. Why don't we have centers where youth who have nowhere else to go can go and get a meal, get a shower, get some warm clothes, and have a place to spend the night? So if we have a bunch of youth who are hitting up liquor stores, to me that reflects poorly on us as a community, not on the youth who are calling out for help.
Michael Redhead Champagne is a community organizer with the group Aboriginal Youth Opportunities. He helped to create a weekly gathering of community members in Winnipeg's North End neighborhood. On November 22nd, at the 8th anniversary gathering, the young leader explained that the weekly meetings and ongoing conversations provide us with proven ways to address the security issues many in the city are facing.
There's actually two different master's theses that exist out there that talk about the work that happens here at the Bell Tower. And so Adele Compton has a thesis that talks from the Masters of Theology perspective about how we can build spirit in our community, and in that way we are preventing violence. And there's also a master's thesis by Jason Civicse from City Planning and Architecture that talks about when you're doing city planning and there are protesters, is that an opportunity to build relationships and also stop violence at a systemic level? The simple version is we want you to do what you can in your day-to-day life to address systemic violence in our community, and we're grateful that we have so many helpers that have done such a thing.
For more information, visit the Facebook pages for Winnipeg Police Cause Harm and Meet Me at the Bell Tower. Commuters in Metro Vancouver were spared a complete shutdown of their bus system during the last week of November, thanks to a deal struck between Unifor, the union representing the system's transit and maintenance workers, and the Coast Mountain Bus Company, the operator of the city's bus transit services. The News Collective at CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam peoples provided coverage of this development on its weekly news program, Democracy Watch. The audio that follows starts with an excerpt from an interview with Gavin McGarrigle, Western Regional Director of Unifor, explaining the issues behind the threatened shutdown, followed by the voices of BC residents reacting to the announcement of the cancellation of the shutdown.
You know, the issues with the increase in ridership has gone up about 18% over the past number of years, and the overcrowding has increased by 36%. So our members take care of students every day, and they see them, you know, being left out in the rain while they're trying to get up to UBC. You know, sometimes two, three, and four full buses pass them by, and then when they do get on the bus, they're crammed in there like sardines. So there's a lot of pressure on the passengers and on the workers as well, because we see increased assaults. We see less and less time being allocated for them to have a break at the end of the line to be able to go to the washroom or have a bite to eat or just simply reset themselves. And, you know, they're not robots, they're humans. So the pressures have been building for quite some time. And our members voted after, you know, several rounds of negotiations, 99.3% in favor of strike action to support the bargaining committee. And we continued even after that on a number of sessions. So finally, for the first time in 18 years, we served strike notice after 29 separate sessions of bargaining with the company. And really, we were focused on working conditions, wages, and benefits. So they're paying themselves and patting themselves on the back for the great job that they're doing. And they talk to the mayor's council and show them shiny PowerPoint presentations, but they're not actually taking care of the workers. And, you know, when we look at comparisons of transit workers, we note that whatever way you look at it, the comparisons are not being done fairly.
So how did you find out that it wasn't going to be a system shutdown today?
Well, I stayed up pretty late last night, so I saw the news. I think it came around like 2 or 3 a.m. this morning. So yeah, that's how I found out.
So you saw it in the middle of the night?
Yeah, it's exam season, so you got to stay up late studying and stuff. So yeah, I saw the news.
And how has your life been impacted so far by the strike?
I live pretty nearby campus, so I could walk if possible, but it's good that the buses are running, just so I save more time in the morning.
And how do you feel about the strike not happening? Are you happy, or...?
Well, I'm happy that the transit workers got their deal through, so it's good for them.
Great. Cool, thank you. So.
Yeah, so how did you find out that there wasn't going to be a transit strike today?
Actually, my mom saw online, and she told me this morning.
What were your plans if there was going to be a strike?
I was planning on driving today, and then tomorrow I was going to skip class.
Have you noticed like a difference during the transit strike in your like day-to-day commute?
Not really. My lines weren't affected too badly, no. But.
And what was your impression of the strike on the whole in terms of the workers demanding for better working conditions and higher pay? Do you have any perspective on that?
I think it's reasonable that they get like better breaks and stuff, definitely. Yeah, that's...
Anything else? No, we're good. Thank you.
Okay.
If the bus comes, you just go.
Okay.
So how did you find out that there wasn't going to be a system shutdown today?
My cousin texted me at 12:30. Like, she's like my roommate, but she texted me and she told me like, hey, the buses are going to be working tomorrow. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have looked.
Okay. And what would you have done if there was a system shutdown?
She has her car on campus, and we would have carpooled together with our other roommates. So it wouldn't have been too bad, but we would have been coming like really early to find a parking spot.
And how have you found the attendance today, given that there was supposed to be a transit strike? Have you seen a notable drop in attendance?
Not in my lab, because like it's a lab, everyone had to come. But when I got to school and the life building was really, really empty, so I thought it was because of that. Maybe not everyone like saw, or like they just decided they couldn't come anymore because plans changed. But it was like really empty in the life building when I came.
Yeah. And what was your thoughts on the transit strike as a whole, like in terms of the workers demanding higher pay and better working conditions?
I don't know about their pay that much, but I do think they deserve like way better working conditions, because I've seen some pictures of like their break rooms and stuff, and it's a little ridiculous like how small their spaces are. So I think they definitely deserve what they're asking for.
Special thanks to Armin Rana, Aiza Yu, Adeline Peng, and the CITR News Collective for providing the audio for that report. Our final feature comes to us from CKUT 90.3 FM in so-called Montreal, the traditional and unceded territory of the Ganegahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Demonstrators gathered near the CLSC de Rosemont in Montreal in a symbolic action organized by Le Mouvement FAS, which stands for Personnes Handicapées pour l'Accès aux Services, or Disabled Individuals for Access to Services in English, on Tuesday, December 3rd, the International Day of Persons with Disabilities. Mobilizing a human chain, they demanded major reinvestments to health and social services, an end to years-long wait lists for care, and for the provincial government to address the needs of individuals with autism spectrum disorders, intellectual and physical disabilities within the province of Quebec. FAS is a coalition whose mission is to advocate for individuals with disabilities and their families, and to collectively promote and defend the right to public social and health services that sufficiently meet their needs. CKUT's Leora Schertzer brings us perspectives from those in attendance.
I'm Tech Saint-Jean-Ménard, and I work for Mouvement FAS, and I've been working with them for like 5 months now. In the recent history, there's been cuts in the budget. As you know it, there were austerity measures, and it affected lots of services, and it's really bad since then, so yeah. People don't have enough money to pay for things they need, some things they have the right to, and yeah, the programs are not enough for them, if they even have access to it. There's a employment crisis right now. It touches it a lot, because lots of disabled people can't find people to work with them. So it's really bad in that way. The government does not do a lot to help anyways. The government should really listen to the people with disabilities, because they're the one who knows what's up. I have family members that are disabled, so it's a link. And I studied political science, so being involved is really important, so I mix them both.
My name is Nathalie Boulet. I work for Autism Montreal, and I'm part of Mouvement FAS protest today. We see a lot of degradation in the system. The system is too big for people, and we saw a lack of humanity in the services after this law, the Law 21. The challenges are big, because they wait a long time in a waiting list. When they have services, they don't have enough service. They have just few services, and they work on, I don't know in English, but in French is episode de service. They give some services during 3 months, and after, people or family needs to do it by themselves. At home, in disability, it's not like we need something, you go to repair a car and after it's okay. No, people with disability live with a disability, and they need services all their life. The waiting list for residential services are around 7 and 12 years. And for social professional services, it's around 5 and 7 years. During this time, people stay at home and they do some regression, because when they don't be stimulated, unfortunately, they have more behavior. They just wait and wait and wait, and after the deterioration of the behaviors, and after it's more difficult to help.
So because of the long wait times, there's an impact on the psychological well-being
And not only just the psychological, also with behaviors. So in autism, people who don't have services in time, they can have more behavior problems. They can lose the school because school is not in capacity to help them. And after they can go nowhere because nobody wants them because they are too challenging.
Hi, my name's Patrick Carey. I've been with the Moriad Handicap. I've been there for 5 years. I donate my time to we're trying to help to get more money. Like the metros, we'd like to get the metros working better for them to get around, for the handicapped buses, more money. I had to wait a couple years for it. And they found me a place in here, and I've been here for 6 years now, and every time they need people to go out and help, they call me to help them to find more volunteers and different things.
That was CKUT's Leora Schertzer speaking to community members who formed a human chain on December 3rd, the International Day of Persons with Disabilities. They demanded increased funding and access to services for those living with intellectual and physical disabilities in Quebec. For more information, visit mouvementphas.org. You're still listening to Groundwire Community News, broadcasting from coast to coast to coast and available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. Now it's time for our community radio report. Groundwire has reported extensively on the student choice initiative introduced by the Ford government, which would have allowed post-secondary students to opt out of paying fees for campus services, including campus radio stations. The anticipated shortfall in revenues would have crippled stations in universities across the province. On November 21st, a major legal victory was scored, which is station managers throughout Ontario breathing a sigh of relief. The Ontario Divisional Court panel ruling on the application by the Canadian Federation of Students and York Federation of Students concluded that the Ontario Minister of Training, Colleges and Universities had acted without statutory authority when implementing the Student Choice Initiative. Randy Reed is the CEO and General Manager of Campus Station Vibe 105 and VX3 Exchange in Toronto and serves as the Vice Chair for the National Campus and Community Radio Association. He explained to Groundwire what was at stake in this court challenge.
Since the Ford government announced the Student Choice Initiative, it kind of sent our members reeling all across the province. Basically, a lot of our members were unable to plan their budgets for the upcoming year. They were forced to have to look at letting go staff or reducing staff allocations in anticipation of having little to no levy to lean on. The levy relationship that campus community radio stations have had across the country for decades now, over 30 years strong, there's never been all-out reversal of that type of relationship in our history. If nothing was reversed, we have about 18 stations in Ontario, we would have lost about a third in the first year, and we're still looking at the potential of a loss of two or three. We would have lost two-thirds by the third year, and it would have been hard for the balance to maintain anywhere beyond 5 years.
Tina Plank is the station manager at Lakehead University-based CILU in Thunder Bay, Ontario, in Robinson Superior Treaty territory and on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and the Métis. She expressed relief at the decision and shares what an unfavorable ruling might have meant for her station and for the community in which it was situated.
Our student levy made up close to about 70% of our operating budget, which was pretty much 100% payroll. And we had to look at that, and we were already operating on absolute minimal staff, which meant in the light of funding changes, we would have to completely change our staff model. and we didn't have a lot of room to do that. So it sent a lot of panic to our team. So we'd be looking at losing a full-time staff member, and the only option for the remaining staff member, myself, would also be not to work there, because it's not a it's so difficult to kind of keep the level of programming and training and that the community and the students have come to know from LU Radio when you are using a staff model of one person. I'm just going to go say it's not possible. But to make that an actual model based on the cuts that we endured because of the Student Choice Initiative would essentially cripple the station and the future of it.
Have you been able to retain anything that might make things better for your station moving forward? Any lessons learned?
We took a look at our sort of staff workload, and we thought right off the get-go, let's just do a huge push. Let's train a whole bunch of new people. Let's get some new radio shows. So inadvertently, that kind of lit a little bit of fire under us, and now we're seeing a large surplus of students coming in to do radio shows, some new community members we're welcoming.
Would you say this was a wake-up call for community radio in Canada? And if so, what lessons has the NCRA learned as a consequence?
Right. So definitely one of the things that we're looking at the NCRA level is ways of supporting our membership with services and strategies that go beyond the traditional relationships that we've had with fundraising and with levy disbursement from our partners at the university level. At the NCRA level, we're looking at a lot of enterprise models that we can lean on. As we kind of face this whole world of digital transformation, we're looking at ways in which our member stations can utilize technology to better service their communities in a broader way.
That was our community radio report. Up next, a short musical break. Heard the New Pornographers with Colossus of Rhodes from their recent album In the Morse Code of Breaklights. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Kaking, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota. Headlines this week were written by Michael Welch, Stefan Christoph, and Catherine Fisher. We also thank Emily Leadham, Armin Rana, Isa Yu, Adeline Peng, and the CITR News Collective, and Leora Schertzer for their contributions. Music this week was by Don Amaro and the New Pornographers. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca. Thanks for tuning in.